612. 1070 WIBC. Donald Davidson here, the talk of gas finale. Good afternoon, Donald.
Good afternoon, David. How are you?
Good, good, good. Now, 1958.
Yeah. First of all, I was asked this question by a fellow I knew, actually, when he was in his mid-teens. And I realized that we wouldn't have time to answer the question in the time allotted, and I don't know how that came across. A regular listener called me today and said that he sympathized with me because he thought I didn't want to answer the question. That's not so. It's just that I knew we didn't have very much time.
Right.
So it's a story and a half. In 1957, they had a new procedure for starting, where they had a separated pit lane, which they'd never had before. Maybe the first at any racetrack in the world. Maybe. Where you actually left the racetrack to go down a separate road.
Really?
To make your pit stop. Could be, yes. But anyway, they had the idea to, instead of lining the cars up 11 rows of three, somebody had the idea to just leave the cars in the pit, in the new pit lane, and then fire the engines up, push them off in single file, and then have them form up on the racetrack. And they gave them two laps to do that. It didn't work out very well, and two cars were eliminated. And so they do that. It worked out well for years. Let's change it. So
yeah.
Anyway, when they realized that that hadn't worked out very well, did they change it back? No. not for another year. And so in 1958, here were the cars are now for the second year in a row, all lined up in the pits. I believe lined up in the order that they qualify, but I'm not positive that that is correct from first to last. It may be. But anyway, at some point, the engines were fired up. Oh, and the thing was that the pace car was to come down the main straightaway, and as it went past the entrance to the track, then the field would come out in single file and then form up behind the pace car. So on this particular occasion, through a miscue, the three cars that made up the front row actually got out onto the track ahead of the pace car. There is one version I've heard is that Lee Elkins, who was the owner of the car on the pole, actually waved to a friend, and the crew mistook it for the signal to push off. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, so off the cars go, and they're all offies except for the two Novis, and they only have two gears. So you have to push start them, and then they can't go very slowly. They're not designed to go slowly.
Right.
And so off they go, and they're hoping that the pace car will catch up with them, which it does not. And so when they get onto the backstretch, the three drivers, Dick Rathman, Ed Elysian, and Jimmy Reese, all signed to each other that the best thing for them to do would just be stand on it, and they would roar around and then
come up,
approach from the rear and then come up to the front. So that's what they did. And so when the field comes around for the end of the second lap, which is going to be the start because it was only two in those days, here comes the pace car with the second row and the third row and the fourth row, and they're coming down for the start, and the other three, I don't remember if it was one went to the inside and two went to the outside or the other way around, but there's one on one and two on the other, and they come flying down. Probably they were coming down on either side just about the time when the race would normally have started, and it was decided that they would send them around one more time.
Right.
That may have made it worse than it would have been. We don't know. But anyway, they come around the next time, and now they're fairly well lined up, except that Dick Rathman on the pole stands on it, way before you normally would have, and Ed Elysian, who wanted to lead the first lap, goes with him. So actually, it was a fairly decent looking start, except that the front row came across in single file, followed by everybody else. Well, anyway, off goes Dick Rathman through turn one and turn two and down the back stretch, and Ed Elysian and he, throughout not really the month, but for the previous week, they'd been back and forth and back and forth trying to top each other to see who could be the fastest. How long? When's our break, by the way? And I'll know how long I can talk about it. 2 minutes. All right. So anyway, everybody for the last 45 minutes, 30 minutes of the day would lay down their tools and watch while these two went out and topped each other. They're not on the track at the same time, but, you know, one would go faster than the other and come in. The other one goes out, goes a little faster, and so on. And it went on that way for about a week. And then they are the two, they're starting 1-2. Alesian actually broke the one-lap track record, but his four laps were a little more erratic than Dick Rathman's, and Rathman ends up with the four-lap qualifying. Little inside story, they actually were sharing digs at that time.
Oh, my.
Yes. So, anyway, Alesian is determined to lead the first lap, so they're going down the backstretch, and he pulls to the left and actually beats Dick Rathman into the turn. But about halfway through the turn, the tail comes out. And what had happened was all of their practicing had been done with light loads. Now he's got 75 right. gallons on board, and apparently the theory is it caught him unaware. So instead of spinning completely around, he's actually going sideways. And then Dick Rathman doesn't know what to do, except that the rule of the racetrack is if there's a car spinning in front of you, you aim for it. Because the theory being that when you get there, it will have gone somewhere else.
Right.
And anyway, just as it appears that Alesian is about to save it, and it then goes all the way around, Dick Rathman then doesn't quite know what to do, and they collect each other, and they go sliding up to the wall, Alesian tail first, Dick Rathman nose first, and they crash into the outer wall. It might have been okay, except that Jimmy Reese doesn't know what to do, so he taps his brake and gets hit by Bob Veith, who's directly behind him, and then Pat O'Connor, running fifth, runs up over Veith and Jimmy Reese and then flips upside down and sustains fatal injuries. And so, anyway, the race runs for like 25 minutes under yellow while they clear a huge accident developed behind them. And that just was one of those things that looked like it was never going to end. And so, anyway, they got the track cleared up and off they went. But they'd lost seven cars, including two of the front row and two of the second row. And Jimmy Reese received damage but was able to get back in the race and finish sixth. And we probably need to take a break right now.
Yeah, we'll come back.
All right,
back
well, we'll come back and with a couple more thoughts on that and then also do the 1913 story.
There we are, Donald Davidson, 620. Set up to the news center. We'll check in with Steve Simpson. Steve. 626 on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on 1070 WIBC. Dave Wilson along with Donald Davidson. We were in 1958.
Yeah, we'll pretty much wrap this one up. This accident resulted in the fatal accident to, the fatal injuries to Pat O'Connor, who was tremendously popular locally from North Vernon. And as I said last night, as I was galloping, see, I couldn't have done this story last night. We didn't have time. But he was a long time North Vernon, but he did actually live in Indianapolis for a short time and went to Ben Davis. And he was in the Indiana National Guard in the tank battalion.
Oh, my.
Yeah, a driver that, back then, all the drivers did service, or most of them did. But anyway, he was terrifically popular, and the accident, a lot of people laughed during the next hour or so, apparently. There was a steady stream of people that were leaving. And I've had several people tell me when I've done talks and so forth, we didn't go back after that.
Yeah.
And it was Jimmy Reese blamed himself, and it probably cost him his own life just a short time later at the end of September. He blamed himself because if he hadn't have braked,
checked up,
then he wouldn't have had Veith hit him and then Pat O'Connor in his mind, and apparently talked about it by a swimming pool that night, I'm told. And then, so in September, he was in this situation where he was racing Johnny Thompson at Trenton in the final lap and ended up going over the wall, apparently in a situation where he thought, if I break, I don't want to take Thompson with me. And so it ended up that it did cost him his life. But And then the other thing, too, was that that was... Many feel that that was Bob Veit's best shot. He was starting inside fourth row. He was a very steady campaigner, brought him home. But there are several people that thought that Veit had the look of a winner that morning. Anyway, the other story, just real quick, from 1913, we finished up with Jules Gou.
Right.
But the gentleman had two stories that he actually had running together, although it was the same year. Gou wins the race by 13 minutes and 8 seconds over the second place. And that was second place was a battle between a Mercer from Trenton, New Jersey, and a locally built Stutz. And coming down for the white flag, the Mercer goes by. A few seconds later, here comes the Stutz entering its last lap, but it's on fire. So Harry Stutz was his own pit manager, so he goes out onto the track and signals the Stutz to come in, and it goes by. And so they wait and wait and wait, and then here comes the Mercer down, takes second place, and all the cars keep running for as many as reasonable to complete the full 500 miles. So peering up to the fourth turn, and then here comes the Stutz, still going, with the flames coming out of it. And Harry Martin, the riding mechanic, who had actually been the winning riding mechanic the year before with Joe Dawson, he's now working for Stutz. They came across to take the checkered flag, and he's actually sprawled out over the hood trying to beat the flames out.
Oh.
Yeah, they didn't used to give up in those days. and the fact that they lost second place, but they did get third, locally built Stutz, and just the fact that it was local, plus this great show of bravery by the riding mechanic, it got a huge cheer.
That's Donald Davidson at 6:30. We'll come right back. We'll have your phone calls on the Talk of Gasoline Alley afternoon.
The exclusive radio home of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 1070 WIBC. Radio Indiana. WIBC. Indianapolis. And MS Communications Station.
Sicarius jury reaches a verdict in...
All right, Joe, thank you very much. Back on the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Definitely, it seems like the fastest hour of the day. I can't believe how fast time goes here when we're talking about this, Donald. Let's head up to Delphi and speak to our friend Jerry. You're up with Donald Davidson, Jerry.
Hi, Donald.
Hello, Jerry.
I really missed Tuesday night.
Oh, at the Brickyard? Yeah, yeah, that was fun. That was a lot of fun this year. Thank you for coming down.
Well, thank you for being there. I'd like to know if you'd profile, well, you just mentioned a little bit earlier, Bob Veit. He just passed away recently, hasn't he?
Yes, he did. In fact, I profiled him at the on one of those nights, I think.
Yeah, you did, but I'd like to hear it again.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, well, Bob Veit was from Northern California, San Francisco area, and was at the Speedway in summary here from 1956 through 70, actually, was his last year at the track. He did not qualify in 61, 66, 69 and 70. He had a really good finishing record. He was never right at the front. 1958, he started fourth, which was the best starting position, and that was the year, as I said before the break, where several people thought that he did look like a winner on race morning. His best finish was his rookie year when he was seventh, and 1956, Federal Engineering Detroit Special, and then he was... ninth in 57, 58 he had the accident, got 26 was his official finishing position. Then he was 12th in 59 and 8th in 60, so he did bring him home. 61 he had a heck of a time and ended up missing it. He was in four different cars and made qualifying attempts in three and ended up not making it. And then he was the first one out in 62 driving for Ray Crawford, McGuire's Miraglis Special. And then he was 26th in 63, 19th in 64, but that was probably his best run. He drove one of the MG liquid suspension cars, a rear-engine Offey that Foyt actually had been assigned to and turned down. He drove it during practice and then said, no, I'm going to go with the front-engine car. So Veit got the hand-me-down, and he actually ran third for a while, which was his best run, but... He dropped out, and you look at the records, and it shows him 19th. Then 65, again, driving MG Liquid Suspension Special. Really neat one. That was painted red. The 64 car was white, and he was out in that one, 24th. 66, he missed, as I mentioned. And then in 67 and 68, he finished 11th in both of those years. When he first came back to the Midwest, he had some really good sprint car runs, and he never won a feature, but he had several seconds and thirds on the high banks and a couple of dirt track finishes as well. But he did very well for a short time at Salem and Winchester and places like that. And he was a crew member. They don't do that anymore, but you'll see him in a couple of crew shots. He was on Jimmy Reese's crew in 1954, along with Johnny Boyd. You'd come back and try to get a ride, and you'd hang around and be a crew member.
Right.
But once he got going at the Speedway, then he kind of backed off sprints, and there were those that thought that he actually had more potential than he showed, but he was a very steady runner. And he was sacked. Where he did not hold back was in 1958, he went to Monza. He went to Monza in 57 and 58. And in 58, he was the fastest of the Americans. Everybody was upstage because Luigi Musso in a Ferrari was the fastest qualifier. He was qualified second. And he was third in the first heat behind Jim Rathman and Jimmy Bryan. He was second in the second heat behind Rathman, and then he broke down late in the final, so he ended up eighth overall. And then they came back, and then the next month in the Milwaukee 200, he was second behind Roger Ward. But the neat thing about Bob Veith in the later years was, oh, he was one of the champion 100-mile-an-hour members that would go to the schools and do the—he was part of the highway safety program where they went to the schools. And so a lot of kids were, you know, remember Bob Veith from doing the lectures. But the neat thing in the later years was that he would come back without a ride, pick one up at the last minute when they used to bring out the gunfighters on the last day, and with very few laps, he looked like he was not the most energetic guy that ever came down the pike, and he had a very lazy walk, and he would come down with a, you know, cigarette lazily hanging out of his mouth and just kind of letting the helmet bag bang against his knee, and it was, if it was too much trouble to walk down to the car, he'd get in, and then about 3, 4, 5, 6 laps, and he'd be up to qualifying speed, and it was just amazing how he could do that every year. And he hadn't been back for years, and he just passed away a short time ago, and he was just one of the great characters of the 1950s and 60s.
There you go, Jerry. Thanks for your phone call. We appreciate it. Bergie, you hang on. We'll take your call and then some others as we can before the top of the hour. Talking Gasoline Alley continues. 6:44 here on 1070 WIBC, the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Donald Davidson here with you. Let's get back to your phone calls. We have lines open at 239-1070 if you want to get on board. Sit down to Taylor Mill, Kentucky, and speak with Bergie. You're up with Donald, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening, gentlemen.
How are you?
I'm doing great, Donald. First off, I got one question my wife and I are very concerned about. Please tell us Tom Carnegie is going to be at the track this year.
Yes, he is.
Ah. Santa Claus is returning for Christmas.
Yes, he is.
Yep.
And secondly, as if I'm on the safety crew at the Kentucky Speedway, so mm-hmm. if you get down there for the RL race, which is a dandy.
Yeah.
Try to look me up. I got the bald head and the sun shining off of it, so you won't miss me.
Okay.
But on a more serious note, I'd like a little bit to know a little bit about Dick Simon's profile, his whole history, and I haven't seen him at the track the last few years.
Golly, speaking of bald heads, the last time I saw Dick Simon, he came up to the photo department about a year ago at the time of the boat show, and so he's into boats now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. So when he was a driver, what was the best he's ever done?
1987, he started sixth and finished sixth.
Okay.
In fact, he probably could have got a third out of that. He ran out of fuel coming in the pits, or at least up at the north end, or enough that he slowed down and was slow coming into the extremely slow coming into the pits, and lost quite a bit of time. So I remember the thinking at the time was that he probably could have got third.
Okay.
And that was by far his best run, I think. I mean, that was the first time he'd ever finished in the top 10. I mean, he'd been there since 1970, and it was 17 years later he finally made the top 10.
Wow.
And then the next year he got ninth, and then that was his last run.
Oh, fantastic. Well, on the 13th, unfortunately, we won't be able to make it for pole day. We've got the ARCA race at Kentucky, but I'll look for you over there. I'll try and look you up on the 14th.
Okay. One final note is that he was third in the first Ontario 500 in 1970. Which was his rookie year. He was around in 69, but 70 was his rookie year at Indianapolis. And
who did he drive for back then?
Himself.
Mostly funded. That's right. He was pretty much an independent, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. He had just got the Travelodge sponsorship at that time.
Okay. Well, he did quite well for himself then for being an independent back then.
Yeah. Jimmy McAreath won it for Foyt, and Art Pollard was second, and Simon got third.
Okay, wonderful. Well, Donald and David, thank you very much, and always enjoy your show. Listen to it on the Internet, and we'll be talking to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bergie.
Bye.
There you go. Bergie, 239-1070, 1-800-571-WIBC. And let's check another call here before we check in with Steve Simpson, and we'll speak to Angelo.
Yes.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Fine. I just wanted to know, my wife's extremely pregnant. And I wanted to know if a baby's ever been born at the Speedway. I heard that there has never been one born there.
You know what? I do not know of one having been born, and it's hard to believe that that's never happened, because I know that some women have come up to the hospital extremely pregnant, and with as many people as there's been there, I mean, maybe over 400,000 in some years.
Sure.
And when you think back into the, you know, the 40s and the 50s and the huge crowds that would show up, and the fact that, you know, they didn't have Lifeline helicopters and stuff like that to get you downtown. I have never heard of one being born on the grounds, but it's hard to believe that it hasn't happened.
Well, my father-in-law is an EMT, so maybe if we put the two together, it will happen.
Okay. Ever get out and walk around the infield, Angelo?
He's never delivered a baby, so.
Right there on the viewing mounds.
Pardon me?
Right there on the viewing mounds and out of turn two.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir. We appreciate it. Let's move on now. We'll head up to the news center. We'll check in with the 6:55, talk at Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson. Let's get back to the phone call. Trying to get one in before the top of the hour. Denise, you're up with Donald.
Yes. Hey, there's no place better than Indy in the month of May.
Right. I agree.
First question, and I know I've heard it before, but who was the tallest driver and what was his height there at the Speedway at the 500?
There was two drivers that were 6 foot six.
6'6".
Yes. The most recent one was Chris Neifel, who ran in 1983 and 84. And the one before that was the infamous Joel Thorne, who ran in the 1930s. When 6 foot six was unusual.
Yeah, he was a giant.
Yes, he was. At that time, yeah, they called him Stork Legs.
Stork Legs.
Yeah.
And my other question was, and I'll hang up and listen to you answer. Have you heard anything about the three Andretti's, Mario, Michael, and Marco, being on the track at the same time, opening day at the Speedway?
You might see that, yes. There's a good chance you might see that.
Okay.
Wow.
All right.
But maybe not in the way you're thinking.
All right.
That's
Denise.
All I can say.
Yeah, very nice.
Better go out and see.
Oh, opening day. That's Saturday. Oh, Donald kind of spilled a little teaser. Very nice. All right. You can't elaborate, Mr. Davidson?
No, you have to go out there.
Got
to
see it. Got to read the book. Yeah. There you go. Get out. That's going to be a great deal anyway. Donald Davidson, thank you very much. Again, don't forget the Talk of Gas and Alleys are archived at WIBC.com. Shows one.